morning. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. Today is Wednesday, the 20th day of April, 2005. It's now about 8:41 a.m. I have Senator Huggins, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins. We're expecting our other members shortly. We're going to start out this morning. We have three things on our agenda. We've been carrying forward the governor's marijuana bill, SB 74. We're going to take another look at that. We're going to take a look at Senate Bill 125 and House Bill 136 today. 125 is a long bill. I imagine what we'll do on that one is open the door, try to take a look at the ramifications of it, where we need to look, and then we'll can carry that bill over, and we'll also be looking at House Bill 136, a drunk driving treatment program, and we'll see what we can get accomplished today. But let's start out this morning with Senate Bill 74. 74, as we've received a lot of material already, but I see Mr. Guarnelli is here. Mr. Guarnelli, would you like to come up and bring us up to speed on recent developments with Senate Bill 74?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guarnelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Senate Bill 74 has had hearings in Senate Hess Committee, in this committee, and on the House side in the House Judiciary Committee. Much of the testimony has been similar in the three committees from both the proponents of the bill and the opponents of the bill. And I think a lot of the same materials have been submitted to all three committees. At this point in time, I'm certainly prepared to respond to any of the committee questions about the testimony that has been heard so far, and to discuss any details of the bill. I do have for the committee's consideration some revised findings that the committee may wish to consider in the bill. The findings as originally drafted were drafted many months ago without the input of the testimony and evidence that has been presented at the hearings, and I think some of the language that was used, some of the wording that was used, provoked some comments that I think were not intended by our office, and I think these findings that I've revised based on the testimony that's been presented and some of the evidence, I think will lay to rest some of the concerns, and I think provide a better record for the court to consider of what judgment the legislature made of some of the evidence that's been presented, both pro and con. So, I know that Senator Terrio had expressed some misgivings generally about findings. I think in this type of case, it's important because we really have a situation where the court is looking at, we believe the court is going to look at what the legislature did, is going to give deference to what the legislature did, and if all the court has before it is a mound of evidence that the legislature had, it sort of has to sort through all that come to some conclusion about what it believed the legislature found. I think with specific findings, I think the legislature then aids the court in focusing its attention on what the legislature found was most important about the evidence, and essentially what the findings do is focus on a couple of areas. Certainly the potency of marijuana, which we heard about, the increase of that over a number of years, the increasing use among young people and Alaska Natives, which I think is a concern for everybody, and in particular testimony by Division of Behavioral Health about the interrelationship between marijuana use and alcohol addiction, and how difficult it is to treat alcohol addiction when you also have marijuana so freely available in the state. So I think those are the kinds of things that we've focused on in the findings, along with some other evidence, and I've got copies of those for the committee if the committee wants to consider that, and I can certainly describe all those findings in as much detail as you wish. So that's a brief background of where we are, and I'm certainly available to answer questions.
In this case, I think it is important that we attach some kind of findings to, as you said, outline or at least accentuate those things that we think are most important about the reason that we're passing this bill and our intent for passing this bill. So Senator Terrio normally strikes findings when they get to this Judiciary Committee with normally the full approval of the rest of the members. In this case, I don't think we're going to attempt to do that. So if you have those ready for
I do, Mr. Chairman.
To have distributed. And when last we met, we were working our way down through a list of witnesses that were going to be provided by Mr. Parker. Mr. Parker, do you have some of those folks available today?
Yes,
I see.
Sir.
Debbie, is it Soleil? Is it Sol? And we also have Michael McLeod Ball. Those are online. And, sir, if you'd like to come up and sit down for just a moment with us. Which would you prefer to go first, sir?
The order I have them, Senator, is Debbie Sol, Jim Welch, and Wes McLeod Ball.
Okay, let's start out with Debbie Sol then. Ms. Sol, are you online with us this morning?
Yes, I am.
Ms. Sol, this is Senator Seekins. If you'll put yourself on the record, and we've been allowing about 3 minutes roughly for give or take for testimony on the bill, and so please go right ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. First of all, I wish to thank you for hearing my statement. My name is Debbie Sol, F-O-U-L-E. I live in Wasilla, Alaska. I'm married, 55 years old, a mother of three grown children, a grandmother. I own my own business. I am a productive and active woman. 7 years ago, my husband and I had a near fatal car accident. I broke everything from my neck down, and then I lost my right leg. I am now in a wheelchair twice a day. The doctors had me on 9 different medications. None of them worked. I was slowly being killed by all the medications they had to give me after our accident. And all of this after they insisted on keeping me alive. Now I have a life of tremendous pain and tremendous loss. I found out from a doctor that I might get some relief from some of the phantom pain and seizures by using marijuana. I was skeptical about this. I raised 3 children in this state, and, you know, I'm older, and I just was real skeptical about this, and I thought about it for over 2 years before I tried it. And I found, to my great surprise, that it worked better than any of the medications that the doctors had given me. I also found that it didn't leave me doped up and unable to function like all the other medications they had prescribed. Some of the medications that they prescribed, the side effects are unbelievable. The number one side effect with one of the medications that I was taking was suicide. The next, kidney failure, liver problems, stomach and bowel problems, not to mention the psychological issues that some of these drugs cause. The problem I have found is that although Alaska supposedly has a medical marijuana law, the state of Alaska has made it impossible for me to find the doctor who will sign my paperwork. When I wanted to try smoking marijuana to relieve my pain, we had to buy it illegally. And I really felt like a criminal. Alaska's medical marijuana law simply doesn't work. Even if I could find a doctor to sign my form, what good does it do if there's no legal way for me to get it? I know that the law allows me to grow up to six plants, but that's not just practical for a lot of patients, including me. Unless you fix the medical marijuana law in this state, patients will have to buy it the same way everybody else does. That's why keeping the protection for personal use under the Raven decision is so important to me. If this new law is passed, the situation for people who use medical marijuana will go from bad to worse. At least now, if I get arrested, passing it without a doctor's signature, I would have some protection in the eyes of the court. You want to take that away from me. Of course, I understand you want to keep marijuana out of the hands of kids. Everybody does. I have three kids. I've got three grown kids and three grandchildren. This is very important. But you have to admit that when marijuana possession was made illegal in 1990, the teenagers went on smoking it anyway, and they can get it easier than I can. Why do you think going back to that kind of law will make any difference now?
Ms. Sola, Ms.
Like me, to get the one medication that helps us the most. I find it odd that our big senators and representatives don't have anything better to do with their time.
Ms. Sowell, please wrap up now. Ms. Sowell, please wrap up.
All right. And outlaw my medication. The doctors are willing to give me any medication, and I mean anything, morphine, Valium, Oxycontin, to help keep me comfortable and turn me into a drug addict until it finally kills me, but they won't sign for medical marijuana. I feel that I will now live longer and be healthier and in a lot less pain because I've chosen to smoke pot. And I agree, we do have a drug and alcohol problem, and none of us want our children drinking or smoking. I would like to know what the percentage
Ms. Sowell, thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have anybody that has questions for Ms. Sowell? Thank you very much, ma'am. Senator Huggins.
Ms. Sowell, Charlie Huggins here. Question for you, reference, I guess THC is the effect that you're looking from. Someone had told me that was available to take orally other than smoking marijuana. Is that true or false?
That's true, but it doesn't work the same. I tried that, and it just does not work. This is the only thing that has helped the seizures in my leg and the phantom pain. Sometimes it's so bad that I can't even put my prosthesis on and walk. And this marijuana is the only thing that has stopped that. And I tell you, to this day, I'm still astounded by this because I never believed that it would help me. But it's the only thing that has helped me. And my doctor told me, he said, we're just going to keep you comfortable until you die.
But assuming that, you know, we can get a pharmaceutical company to produce THC that would provide you relief, would you think that that would be a good alternative?
You know, I wish that they would do something like that because there are so many patients like me that need some help, and we have to do this illegally. I met a man the other day from Toke who is 72 years old, who is a big company owner up there, and he's doing the same thing I'm doing because we can't find doctors. You can call the state, you can call Juno, and they'll tell you there's 250 people on the medical marijuana list, but they will not give you the name of a doctor. I've called all the hospitals, I've called all the pain clinics, I've called everybody. Okay. I can get no one to help me.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Parker, who would you like next?
Jim Welch is next, Senator.
Jim Welch, are you online with us this morning? I didn't see that he checked in.
Maybe I wore Jim out, Senator.
So far, I've got two that appear to have checked in. One was Debbie, and one is Mr. McLeod Ball. Was that who you'd like next?
Yes.
Mr. McLeod Ball, are you online with us, sir? Wes, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Can hear you now. If you will introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to speak on this important bill. First, I'll state very briefly, reiterate something that was said in the previous hearing. We believe it's near impossible for this committee to reach a full understanding of the issues involved with the abbreviated hearings that you've had. And so we object to the record in that sense. You've acknowledged that you've received many documents and studies and reports. It's a lot of information that's been submitted to you. We believe it's just next to impossible to reach a full understanding of the meaning of all of that material with just a series of six or seven 3-minute presentations by folks who oppose this bill. We believe the weight of the evidence, if it's fully understood by the committee, would clearly show that the offered justifications for this bill are not accurate. That being said, let me see if I can try to bring some focus on this. And I will say, by the way, Mr. Chairman, I am submitting written testimony. My comments here today are simply intended to highlight certain parts of that and also to expand upon just a couple of themes that are presented in that written testimony. The focus here is on the privacy rights guaranteed under the Alaska Constitution. The first issue to consider is, what does the privacy right include? Is there a basis for taking away a portion of that right? A lot of the testimony that you've heard by the proponents of the bill deals with the commercial cultivation of marijuana, selling and distributing marijuana, providing it to kids, driving while under the influence of marijuana. I would say almost all of the testimony offered by the proponents deals with one or more of those issues. None of those are within the privacy right. There is no restriction on your ability to regulate in that area. The possession for personal use in the home, the possession of small amounts for personal use in the home, for use in a way that does not adversely impact others, that is within the privacy right. Testimony by the proponents of the bill has acknowledged that this is not the problem. The possession and use of small amounts in the home that does not adversely affect others was deemed by the state trooper who spoke to you at the outset of these hearings as a rare occurrence and something that is not their problem. They don't have an issue with that. But yet, this bill affects that particular right more than any of these other issues that I've just mentioned. This bill takes the amounts of 4 ounces or less and criminalizes possession in that category. And just to bring that home, if somebody has a single joint, hands it to his neighbor, and he's in high school or college and is under age 21, that person subjects him or herself to imprisonment up to 10 years. If somebody has a single marijuana seed in an ashtray at home, they subject themselves to imprisonment for up to 90 days. There is a regimen of punishment in this bill that has not been shown in any past occurrence or in any present situation to work to reduce the use of marijuana throughout society. And so we would ask you really to focus in on that particular issue. There's been discussion of the Raven decision from the 1970s. That was not really about marijuana. It was more about privacy. It acknowledged in that decision that there is some risk to the use of marijuana, but simply said that that risk does not justify regulation of small amounts for use in the home. It also acknowledged in that decision that kids might be present in the home in which marijuana is also present, and said that even so, that was an insufficient threat to public safety to justify regulation. So we would ask you to consider that the reasoning of the Raven decision, rather than simply look on the Raven decision as one that legalized marijuana. We believe it's very important that the findings should match the facts. I'm pleased to see that Mr. Quinelli has offered revised findings. I would like to have had the opportunity to look at those ahead of time so I could comment on those and to see if they are any better than the existing findings, which have been acknowledged to be an overstatement of the asserted justifications for the bill. I would hope that the committee might give us the opportunity to review those findings and comment on them, but that will be up to you. I would like to point out a number of the overstatements that have been made by the proponents of the bill, because the findings are based on the underlying studies and facts that have been presented to you. It's important for you to realize that the oral comments, anyway, and some of the written comments are really misleading as to what the underlying studies said. Some of the scientific experts that have already testified against this bill have told you about some of that, but let me just make a couple of additional points. There were assertions about usage by kids, and the state has referred to a 1990 study to claim that 22% of kids of marijuana users use marijuana themselves, yet only 5% of kids of non-users use marijuana. Well, there's problems with that assertion. First, the study, the 1990 study, only 4 pages of that study were submitted to the committee for review. The study was much longer and had much more detail than the 4 pages that were submitted. If you look at the full study, you will see the study itself says you cannot draw general conclusions from the statistics that were reported because the study size, the sample size, was too small. The state didn't tell you that in offering its testimony. There are also methodology and reporting problems. Kids of non-users are less likely than kids of users to acknowledge that they themselves have used the drug. That throws off the 22% and 5% figures by quite a bit. The usage rates that are reported in that study confirm that there has been no increase in usage rates since the Raven decision. Also, the testimony ignored the actual recommendations of that report. I'll get to this a little bit later. But the recommendations generally of that report were to focus on prevention and treatment, not on criminalization. So it's important for this committee to realize that simply listening to the oral testimony does not give you a full flavor of what the actual studies that have been submitted to this group represent. There was another important assertion that was made by by the proponents of the bill. They stated that 15% of rape suspects have marijuana in their system. Well, if you look at the study from which that from which that fact was drawn, you will see that study focused more on the presence of alcohol in the system of rape suspects than the presence of marijuana. That same study showed that 70% of those rape suspects had had alcohol in their system, and they deemed the 15% of suspects who had marijuana such a trivial amount that they did not study it further. They didn't drill down to get more information. However, with the alcohol, they drilled down and went to several additional layers of evaluation to try to determine what was driving that. So the study itself implied that the issue of marijuana and aggression was not really one to be studied further. Rather, the focus should be on the presence of alcohol in the systems. So again, it's important for the committee to really come to a full understanding of what all these studies that have been submitted to you show. We're also concerned that there may be a predisposition on this bill that has been reflected in some of the previous hearings. For example, in the Hess hearing, there was a single administration official who spoke against the bill. She was chastised for doing so. However, there have been a number of administration officials who have spoken in favor of the bill, yet they have been actually praised for doing so. It seems to me that there is sort of a chilling effect on the opponents of the bill who may be within the administration. And for these reasons, we believe that even if the findings are left in the bill in the original form, that the court will choose to go beyond those findings, look behind those findings to see what the actual studies and reports say. There is a lot of cases in both the U.S. and Alaska courts that show that when a fundamental right is involved, the courts will not simply defer to the legislature in their findings. most legislation, of course, they will. There's great deference given to the legislature and legislative findings in looking at the purpose of a particular state action. But that's not the case when a fundamental right is involved, and the privacy right is involved in this case, as has been discussed. There's one case in particular which is referenced in my written testimony, Justice Clarence Thomas, who has said that regardless of what information is relied upon by the state, or excuse me, by the legislature, a legislature cannot turn black into white and cannot turn slavery into freedom simply by saying it is so. Now we believe there's something of the same kind of thing going on here in this case. The great weight of the good scientific evidence here shows that marijuana has some risks, but not great risks. Certainly no more so than were present in 1975 when the Raven decision came down. The Raven decision stands for the proposition that the privacy right is paramount unless there is a compelling interest that's, and the state action is narrowly drawn. And we believe those factors are not present in this case.
Wes, we'd like you to wrap up for us, please.
Yes, I will wrap up, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned before about the 1990 study that the state relied on to assert that that kids are more affected now. Well, if you look at that full study, and again, only four pages were submitted to you by the state, but if you look at the full study, that study says that kids who do poorly in school, kids who are emotionally stressed, kids who are abused are more likely to abuse drugs. A program that does not address these factors was shown to be, a program that does not address these factors will be bound to fail in trying to lessen drug abuse. Yet that is the focus of this bill. This bill will not focus on those factors. It will simply criminalize minor possession. Rather, the focus should be on education and on prevention and on the science, a wealth of which has been submitted to this committee for your consideration. We believe that if you really focus on all of this scientific evidence, you will not simply criminalize minor possession of small amounts in a home. Rather, you will alter the penalties, you will drastically modify the findings. Hopefully, you will defeat this bill. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. McLeod Ball? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And also, for the record, I would say that regardless of anyone's perception of our inability to understand the issue, we each individually will do the best that we can and will probably operate within the full scope of our constitutional authority. Do you have someone else, Mr. Parker?
Online, Senator, that's the list.
I believe that's all we have online this morning. Would you like to do some kind of a wrap-up to summarize your position here?
Yes, thank you, Senator, and thank you for your patience in all this. We have assembled what we think are the best experts in the country on this subject to respond to the findings. Now today the Department of Law offers all new findings, replaces the entire second section of the bill, reduces the findings from 19 to 9. I've done a quick contrast and compare here just sitting at the witness table. It's hard to do because they're in different forms. I certainly wish the experts had a chance to look at the findings the department proposes to you to pass into law before they commented. Because I'm not an expert, because I've just seen it, I would have to say that I don't think this bill is ready to go with these findings uninvestigated at this point.
Okay.
We haven't got to the penalty section yet, which turns misdemeanors into felonies, but you know all that better than I do. Perhaps the best thing I can say to you now is thank you for your patience. I would like very much to spend a little time with this proposed amendment.
Okay. We have received a great deal of information. Let me just go down through some of what I show, and correct me if I'm wrong. We have two notebooks that were provided by the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, marijuana information provided by you on April 9th, 2005, notebook one and notebook two. We also have from the American Civil Liberties Union marijuana information on April 8th, we received notebooks 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we have also received on April 15th from the American Civil Liberties Union marijuana information notebooks 1 and 2. Those are available for anyone to be able to examine, and I think we've distributed copies, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Mr. Holmes? We've got them available. One set. Okay. Then we have also from the ACLU, I believe, a book called Marijuana Myths and Marijuana Facts. We have another one called Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence by Mitch Earlywine. Another one, America's Rethinking Our Tragic Crusade Against Drugs, America's Longest War. Is that also provided by the ACLU?
I don't recognize that one, Senator, but
okay.
Good book.
We also have this document here.
Yes, sir.
Court proceedings. And we have another one called Effective Drug Control Toward a New Legal Framework, King County Bar Association Drug Policy Report, 2005, and the written testimony by Mr. McLeod Barr, which he alluded to earlier today. Is there anything that I've forgotten there?
We have two more books.
Two more books, yes.
I think my staff checked two of the books out of your library.
Yeah.
Marijuana Reconsidered by Mr. Grinspoon.
Yeah. Marijuana Reconsideration and Marijuana the Forbidden Medicine.
Yep.
We have those as well. Is there anything that we have forgotten there?
That sounds like a pretty comprehensive survey of what you've been given, Senator.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have Senator Terrio, and quite some time ago, and I forgot to mention it, Senator Guest joined us, so our committee is complete. Let's just take up a little housekeeping matter here then. Thank you very much for your presentations. Are there any questions for Mr. Parker before?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Parker, one of my concerns, I as much as anybody sitting before you today, feel strongly about privacy, individual rights, and things of that nature, and very sensitive to that point. One of the difficulties I have is this. One of the rules in our family, we still have two children that are in high school and one that's in college, is that to the extent we can, that when they're hanging out with kids, we try to be as protective as possible of who those kids are. Which gets fundamentally to my concern is that out of these households that parents are using, kids are exposed to, may or may not be using themselves, comes the potential exportation of a mentality on the school grounds where myself and my wife as a parent cannot control the association because it's forced association. Because, I mean, you're sitting in the classroom. Could you just give me your thoughts about, you know, what are parents to do?
You mean, Senator, that the court's finding on the...
I'm not interested in the courts. I'm interested in the proposition, the sociological dilemma of parents in the community and what kids are seeing and experiencing and the mentality and how you answer that proposition. Because I don't know the answer, but I've been asked that, and I'm faced with it myself as a parent.
I think I know what you mean, Senator. Let me make sure I got the question right. You mean did the court's finding?
I'll say one more time. I'm worried about the courts. I'm talking about kids that come from an environment where marijuana is used in the house and what have you, and the potential exportation of use or the mentality of use going to, in this case, the school site.
So, in other words, did all this produce a mentality that makes drugs in the schools more prevalent?
Parker, could you pull that microphone around? It's kind of directional. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's good enough for government work.
No, Senator, the answer lies in the other direction. The way to keep children from drugs, from marijuana, is to control and regulate it. If we continue to outlaw it, even against the court's constitutional findings, we will find what we have found for the last 15 years. There's just more marijuana than before. I think the trooper's testimony, these fellows have worked hard their whole careers to stop this, and their testimony is it's not stopping. So we must take a different tack if we're going to try to do something about drugs in the schools. Ratcheting up the penalties, especially on young people, making them felons where they would have been simple misdemeanants, is not the answer. It is exactly wrong. It is the reason we have problems with drugs in the school today, because of our approach to prohibiting it instead of regulating it. That would be my answer, Senator. It's a very good question.
Senator, go ahead, Senator Huggins.
If I might, a second question. And it has one to do with, I was in the military for a little while once upon a time, and one of the things that military leaders are faced with is these young men and women, in this case, come to Anchorage, to Fairbanks, Big Delta, wherever it might be, King Salmon, and other places. There's a federal law which they have to abide by. And then we immerse them in our state where we have a conflicting state law. But that's a pretty tough dilemma to put those kids in. My son will be in the military here in a couple years, and he will be a leader, and he will have to abide by that federal law. And I don't know how you, when you're the leader of our young people that are doing our country's business, and they're in Alaska, that creates a pretty tough environment for the leadership to be able to deal with. And maybe a question for the young people and where they go on this fence. Your thoughts?
My thoughts, briefly, Senator, are that adults in Alaska make choices about alcohol and tobacco and prescription drugs, all sorts of things. And Alaska adults make choices about marijuana, too. The federal law, all those things must be taken into consideration by each individual, but adults in Alaska enjoy that right to choose under the Constitution.
Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
The issue of whether regulation would take care of the problem, we regulate tobacco products, but yet tobacco products by underage smokers is still a problem.
It is, but it's down, and the children tell us it's now easier to get marijuana than tobacco because of that. One's regulated, one's not.
So, Mr. Parker, let me see if I understand this. Are you advocating that we logically extend this argument that anything that's illegal will cut down the use of it by making it legal and regulating it?
Sir, I'm trying to confine my comments to marijuana in this bill.
But wouldn't that logically extend to cocaine, heroin, any other drug? You're saying the way to cut down the use is to make it legal and regulate it.
I don't mean to imply or infer that. I just know this. When it comes to marijuana, we have had a long 30-year experiment in this state about decriminalizing it, recriminalizing it, now felonizing it. And I think the answer is becoming pretty clear that we're moving in the wrong direction if we're trying to eradicate things that the troopers have spent their careers on and tell us that it is still booming, the business is booming, millions of dollars a year. I believe the answer is in a different direction. We regulate alcohol. We regulate tobacco. I think we ought to regulate marijuana.
Okay. Why do you think people like Mr. Guinelli want to keep it illegal?
Well, Mr. Guinelli would be the best one to answer that, Senator.
Well, I'm just asking you about, I can ask him that. I'm asking you, why do you think that? So if you want to avoid that question, go ahead. Why do you think that?
Why do I think?
I know it's your question in your committee, but that just seems
this
like
is my committee. And I want to know.
I want to do the best I can to answer your question.
I want to know, why is it that there's an attitude against it? I'm not saying just Mr. Guinelli, but why do people want to keep something that's so harmless then illegal? What's the reason?
Well, the Assistant Attorney General is a longtime public servant. It's the governor's bill. I believe he's doing his job. I assume he also believes it, but I don't know what makes Mr. Guinelli.
It appears to me that there's at least two universes of people who say, oh, it's harmless, just go ahead, regulate it, and other people are saying it's not harmless and it should be illegal to use it and to sell it and buy it and grow it and all the rest of the stuff that goes along with it. I'm just trying to figure out, is it, because what I've gotten so far is that it's a matter of enlightenment. Those people who truly understand the scientific background will come over to one side. Is that what it is? I mean, that's what I heard in the testimony.
I don't think one side's enlightened over the other, Senator. Generally, there was a poll done during the campaign last year. There's about 45% of the Alaska population dug in on either side. They are not swayed by arguments or advertisements either way. One side thinks marijuana is evil and should be eradicated from the land. The other side thinks it's here to stay and we should do something about regulating it. In the middle are 10% of the voters. When it came to medical marijuana, they voted yes. 56% voted yes. When it came to legal marijuana, the proposition last time, they voted no, 55 to 45, 56, 44, something like that. So that poll seems to be true. The 45 that are dug in on either side and don't hear the other side arguments, and the 10% in the middle. This testimony, these books, these papers by the experts, is meant to present our side of that argument to, I suppose, the 10% of the other 45% are dug in. And the state's is aimed at the other side of that case. You're in a terrible position of having to decide which side you're on.
And whose experts we listen to.
And whose experts you listen to, and which, who in your district you listen to. It's a substantial minority, 45%, and not legalizing it one thing, making them felons is quite another.
Well, and it is interesting because in this very committee, we have bills on methamphetamines and on marijuana. And in this very committee, if I take this logical extension that if we regulate and make methamphetamines legal, the problem will be reduced. And I have a hard time making that logical extension, so I have a hard time making the direct application.
Of course, Senator, for the record, I am not advocating the legalization of methamphetamines. Just here to talk about Senate Bill 74. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your
patience
and for your answering my questions.
And for yours, Senator.
Other questions for Mr. Parker? Thank you very much. So your testimonies, your witnesses are concluded at this point?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. We have before us a senator, the two senators, Sir Senatorio, revised finding. I think what we'll do is give the members a chance to take a look at that before we propose it as amendment to the bill. We've completed the public testimony on this bill so far. Senator French?
I just wanted the opportunity to ask Mr. Quinelli a couple of questions.
Sure. Mr. Quinelli? Thank you for joining us again.
Thank
Senator
Mr.
French,
Chairman.
Go ahead.
And I should have sent these over as an email to give you a chance to prepare, and so maybe that you just have to go back and check your records and let me know in the future. But I just wanted to know just some statistics, and you can pick any recent relevant period for which you have complete numbers, whether it's 2004 or before. But I'd just be curious about the number of arrests each year for marijuana, any charge, possession, distribution, and so forth. And the number of convictions and the number of cases disposed of at the highest charge, if you see what I mean. The number of cases where you charge a C felony and the conviction is for a C felony, or if that's trackable.
Through the chair, Senator French, that is trackable, and I can probably provide you with much of that information probably later today. I've been collecting some of it in preparation, helping Department of Corrections prepare the fiscal notes, and so I have some of that information in my office, and I can just get it to you later.
It was on my mind to call you yesterday, and I should have done that. just one of
the... Go ahead, Senator Frank.
Someone testified, it may have been Mr. McLeod Ball, about giving a marijuana cigarette to someone under 21. And I guess I just need to know from your view, and I'm kind of guess I'm going off your chart, this one, whether you agree with that analysis that giving a marijuana cigarette to someone under 21 would be a B felony under this bill.
Through the chair, that's correct. Distributing marijuana to someone under 21 would be a B felony offense if they're under 21. Right now, under current law, you have to be under 19 for it to be a B felony offense, and there has to be three years of age difference between them. So this this proposal seeks to amend that.
And just so I'm clear, right now, under the way the law is, if an 18-year-old person gives a marijuana cigarette to an 18-year-old person, what crime is committed?
Through the chair, delivering a one marijuana cigarette, someone 18 to 18, in other words, less than 3 years difference. At this point, I believe that would be a Class B misdemeanor. I think that's one of the holdovers, certainly from the early 80s period, and I think that's a weakness in the current law.
And under this bill, 18-year-old to 18-year-old would be a Class B felony.
That's correct.
Thank you. Mr. Guarnelli, I'm just curious. We've heard in testimony earlier that those people that work in the administration who agree with the premise of this bill receive accolades, and those who don't receive some kind of chilling behavior or disapproval. Are you aware of anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the testimony that you heard related to a hearing in Senate Hess at which Barb Brink, director of the Public Defender Agency, testified in opposition to the bill, and Senator Wilken took some exception to her doing so in her official capacity rather than in a private capacity. So I think that's probably what the testimony relates to. I think that, Senator Wilken had his reasons for expressing that view, but that's the only thing that I have heard in all of these proceedings or elsewhere.
Have you had any pressure from farther up the chain on what your position on this bill should be?
Mr. Chairman, I know that the governor and the attorney general support this bill. I know that they would like to see it become law. However, I've been involved in dealing with marijuana issues for many, many years. I've been involved in some of the litigation. I wrote the state's petition to the Supreme Court trying to get the Supreme Court to review the Noy opinion, which came out from the Court of Appeals. I've done a lot of the literature research myself on marijuana, and it doesn't take any pressure to get me to be on this side of the issue.
Would you believe that legalizing and regulation of marijuana would cut back use by young people?
Mr. Chairman, I think that I'm not certain I know the answer to that, but I think that Mr. Parker's opinion that marijuana ought to be regulated is it's an interesting concession because essentially what the right to privacy argument and the Raven decision says is the state, based on marijuana that existed back in the 70s, the state didn't have a sufficient interest in regulating marijuana, in criminalizing marijuana. In essence, what the court was saying, and what all the people who say, talk about right to privacy and the state doesn't have a sufficient interest, is that it's none of the legislature's business to deal with marijuana in the home. And I think that the evidence that's been presented certainly shows that it is. I think that parental use parental approval of marijuana, having it in the home, having it available, makes it more accessible to kids. I think the legislature has a strong interest in doing that. But what Mr. Parker said was the legislature ought to regulate it. And I think that if the legislature has the power to regulate it, has the power to set up a marijuana control board like the alcohol control board, if the legislature has that authority to do that and regulate it in that sense, then I think that's a concession that there is a sufficient state interest in the legislature to take another policy choice, and that is to criminalize it and to punish it. I mean, frankly, I think that makes our point. I think there is sufficient evidence in the record that the legislature has a strong interest in dealing with marijuana in the way that it chooses. It sees the policy approach being the best. And whether that's regulation or criminalization, I think that's the legislature's choice. I don't see any other state in the country regulating it. Alaska's the only place where recreational use is legal, and this bill seeks to change that.
Senator Theriault.
You indicated that you've been tracking the number of cases that would be swept in to in dealing with the Department of Corrections. I just looked at the fiscal notes. We don't have a Department of Corrections fiscal note, and I'm very curious on what that is.
Through the chair, I'm aware of that. We just had a discussion yesterday in the governor's office about getting a Department of Corrections fiscal note, and that is, it's in the works right now. I'm compiling statistics for them, and I'll be meeting with Portia Parker later today to go over those statistics and analyze that. My initial reaction from looking at the statistics is it's not going to be a significant change, but I'll let her make that judgment.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Guinelli at the moment? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Guinelli, I previously asked Mr. Parker about the legal dilemma between the federal law and the state law. Could you just give us your perspective of not about a soldier versus, you know, a local citizen sort of thing, but what it does legally from your perspective working in the legal profession here in the state?
In other words, that marijuana is illegal at the federal level, right? But through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think it's certainly I think it's confusing to the public. I mean, I think that people are legitimately confused about the status of marijuana. They see on the one hand that it's illegal under federal law, and in fact a Schedule I controlled substance, and there's been some criticism of the federal classification as a Schedule I controlled substance. But and I think I mean, frankly, when I talk to people, they say, well, yeah, marijuana is, you know, we can have marijuana, but what about federal law? I mean, you know, shouldn't we be worried about the feds? As a practical matter, the federal authorities don't get involved in, you know, marijuana at the, you know, in the ounce level, in the pound level. They have certain criteria, and I think it was somewhere in the several pounds before they would get involved. So, I mean, the feds definitely take a hands-off approach. If there's a large marijuana growing operation, they will get involved. They have left it to the state, and I think they view it as a state issue and a state problem. And I think that's probably appropriate. I know that, you know, we all bristle when the feds get too involved in our business. Sometimes, at least in this case, I wish maybe they were a little more involved. But I think it's a divergence of approaches that I think really shouldn't exist on something like an illegal drug. And I think this bill corrects that.
Yeah, but just for the purposes, the one where that cuts across, it really does concern me. I mean, we have I forget the number of military people here in the state now, but you know they go through random drug testing every so often, and they are subjected to that law, and hence, I mean, it's a zero tolerance thing. That does concern me, and then the dilemma that creates for those particular peoples. Thank you.
Hey, Senator French.
Just on that point, I worked 8 years on the slope, and I was subjected to random drug testing, and I wasn't subjected to any dilemma whatsoever. I knew if I use drugs, I'd lose my job. So I just, it wasn't the only reason, but it's, for folks in the military, I guess I'd assume they'd, or maybe I misunderstood your point. Maybe you're concerned about criminal prosecution or just being separated from the
point is that last week they lived in Florida, this week they live in Alaska, and people say marijuana's legal here, and all the buddies are hanging out. Well, sure, marijuana's legal here, and they, for whatever reason, based on whatever rationale they come up with, they happen to use marijuana. They do a random drug test in a zero environment. They're out of here. That's the dilemma I'm concerned about.
A mismatch between the laws.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Guess. I'm sorry, Guess.
Thank you. Mr. Guanella, I wanted to go back to something you said previously. And maybe just an example. Can you tell me someone who's uses marijuana for personal use right now in their home, if this law passes and this bill passes and becomes law, how that person's, what will change in that person's life? Or in that person's situation?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I have never heard it expressed by any law enforcement agency, and whether it's the troopers who have statewide jurisdiction or municipal police, that they would do anything different in terms of marijuana investigations of personal use in the home. There are a lot of other offenses out there to be investigated without concerning the police with marijuana use in the home. On the other hand, if the police are there in the home legitimately because they've been called there in a 911 call, a domestic violence assault, probation, some other reason, and there's marijuana there, they certainly won't hesitate to take it and to ask the DA to file some additional charges. But I don't see that. The focus of their efforts have been for a long time marijuana growing, trying to stem the supply that is out there, the problem is that the recent decisions by the Court of Appeals, first in the Noy case and in the Crocker case, have limited the police ability to get search warrants to deal with marijuana growing. And that's what ought to change. The marijuana growers ought to be the most concerned about this bill. I mean, they're the ones whose lives are going to be disrupted by this bill, because it's going to allow the police what they were able to do just a year ago, until the Court of Appeals issued the Crocker opinion, to get search warrants to investigate those cases. That's what's going to change.
So if that changes, then the price goes up. But
through the chair, that
would be the impact.
That's usually what happens when supply goes down. If demand is also not reduced, and I mean we're hoping that by sending a strong message out that demand will be reduced as well. But yeah, I hope the price does go up.
Can I just ask one more? And is that also the case with knock and talks, that law enforcement believes that there won't be any increase in, I understand the calls, but a lot of times law enforcement does knock and talks, and is, can you address that as well?
Through the chair, the police technique of knock and talk is simply, if they suspect there's drug activity, to go up and knock on the door and see if the people will admit it, and oftentimes they do. Usually that activity is geared at getting information about marijuana growing, and not simply to get marijuana that is being used personally. I mean, they use that to get information about where marijuana is coming from and who actually is growing it. You'd have to address that to a police agency, but I don't anticipate any huge increase in that.
Go ahead, Senator Guess.
So if the focus is on growing and the supply side, and I appreciate that, I guess, can you explain to me why the bill focuses on the on the possession side and the 1 pound of 4 ounces and 4 ounces to one, why that's the policy call on getting to the growing? And I'm sorry, I'm not well versed in this issue.
Through the chair, the bill definitely does draw different lines in terms of what amount of possession triggers either misdemeanor penalties or felony penalties. Currently, it takes over a pound of marijuana to in possession to be a felony. This bill would propose to reduce that to 4 ounces. Captain Harrington testified in this committee that 4 ounces is a lot of marijuana. I mean, you're talking about $1,000 to $1,500 of value. You're talking about something that makes perhaps in excess of 400 marijuana cigarettes. It's the type of thing, because what his testimony was, because THC potency decreases over a period of time, the person either has to use an awful lot to use it up before the THC degrades, or they have to sell it. And so if you've got a quarter pound, our view is if you've got a quarter pound, that is a lot of marijuana, and that is something that that the law ought to discourage with felony penalties. And we believe that to the extent you discourage possession, and you discourage possession of the larger amounts, you're discouraging growing, you're reducing the supply, and you're, as Captain, there was a different trooper captain who testified in Senate Hess, and his testimony was because of the inability of the troopers to eradicate marijuana growing, The supply is growing. They're seeing more and more of it going out to rural villages. To the extent you reduce that supply by increasing the penalties for possession of certain amounts, to the extent you reduce supply by allowing the troopers to go in and start investigating marijuana growing again, I think you reduce its availability generally, you reduce its accessibility to kids, and you reduce its accessibility to rural Alaska villages. I think all those go part and parcel with cutting down on marijuana availability in Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator French.
Just a follow-up question on that. Then I guess the question that pops into my mind is the why not focus on that? Because it seems like you're on pretty solid ground there, that marijuana is more expensive, marijuana is more potent, marijuana, you know, the idea of lowering to 4 ounces the amount you need to make a felony, you know, might be a rational call. But I guess that's just one portion of this chart, and there's five others. One makes it a B felony for one 19-year-old to hand a marijuana cigarette to another 19-year-old. Part of it makes it a crime to have any, even if you're not using it while you're in a car. Some of it makes it a crime to possess any amount in your home. And so it just strikes me that, you know, if you're aimed at drug growing and drug production, and I think you'd have the support of everybody on this committee if that's where you're focused, that sort of splits the troublesome argument away and leaves us all total agreement.
Through the chair, the specific proposal to make it a B felony for young people to give other young people, younger people, even small amounts of marijuana, I think is I think it's a reflection of the new reality about marijuana. What the troopers have testified in this and other committees is that because it's potent, it's often sold on a cigarette by cigarette basis, particularly in rural Alaska. Because it's so expensive on a per ounce basis, really kids can only afford, you know, one or two cigarettes at a time. And so I think what you have is a situation where that's become the normal vehicle for selling is a cigarette at a time, rather than what it used to be in the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s is, you know, an ounce at a time. And I think that this is trying to get at you know, that new reflection of reality and trying to, and because I think we've got two things here. I mean, one, we've got smaller and smaller amounts being the normal vehicle for marijuana being sold. And second, we've got it going to kids. And that was a reflection of that. You know, is that the most important part of this bill? No, certainly not. But I think we tried to reflect the current reality of the way marijuana is being used and the patterns of usage, and tried to deal with that. You know, that was the rationale behind it.
Actually, this is just more of a long comment or discussion. I know this bill's leaving committee fairly soon, maybe minutes or maybe hours, I'm not sure, but I guess from my own perspective, I would appreciate having the opportunity to review the statistics that Mr. Guarnelli's going to provide. I'd like an opportunity to review the findings that we were given this morning, and given the opportunity perhaps to prepare an amendment, I could have all that first thing tomorrow morning. That's my request, I guess, of you.
Thank you, Senator French. Mr. Guarnelli, just to be fair, in total, I'm trying to figure out what motivates everybody. What do you think motivates the side that does not want this bill to pass?
Mr. Chairman, I think that there are probably a variety of motivations. I'd like to think that, you know, the ACLU motivation is simply a matter of trying to preserve its perception of constitutional rights wherever and whenever it can, regardless of the context. I think that for other people, Debbie Soule, who testified, and Jim Welch, who would have testified, who was testified in Senate Hess and was a multiple sclerosis patient and got some relief from marijuana. I think that some of those people have concerns about medical marijuana. As I testified at my very first appearance here, this bill does not make any change to the medical marijuana laws, and I could describe those laws and if you want. So I think that there's a certain segment who has concerns about medical use, and then I think there's a whole other segment that simply has, likes to use marijuana. It's another form of, it's another recreational way to become high, to become intoxicated, and that's something they like doing. I think that they don't see that it goes beyond the four walls of their house, or they like to think that it doesn't. And frankly, I think that it does. So I think there's probably a variety of motivations.
Thank you. Senator Guess?
Yes. Dean, in response to some of the testimony that we heard on medical marijuana, has, at least from the one person who testified today, it might be that our current law isn't doing what we intended it to do, at least the people who passed the initiative. Have you all looked at the issue that was raised today in kind of, looking at a comprehensive reform bill like this?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, first of all, this bill does not change medical marijuana laws in any way. I don't think there's anything that her testimony, Ms. Soule's testimony today was, quote, state of Alaska has made it impossible for doctors to prescribe marijuana. Actually, I think the bill makes it very clear that doctors don't have to prescribe it. They just, it's just a recommendation, and as long as they talk to their patient about it and the pros and cons, that's enough. There doesn't have to actually be a prescription. She also said that, I can grow, I know I can grow up to six plants, but sometimes that isn't practical for some marijuana users. Six plants can be a lot. The law specifically says only three of them can be mature plants. Captain Harrington said that, they had a recent marijuana growing operation where they had five big plants, and that was a commercial operation. So I think the legislature has actually done a very good job of saying, okay, three mature plants, three immature plants to sort of have a rotating crop. I think that makes sense. And in addition, they said it doesn't have to be the patient himself who grows those. It can be, the statute says you can have someone called a caregiver, someone, even outside of your family who does the growing for you. And because there was concern at the time that, well, what happened if my caregiver is on vacation or sick, there's a concept in the Alaska marijuana, medical marijuana law, really different from a lot of other states, for an alternate caregiver. I mean, somebody who can take that person's place. So you've really got three people, the patient, a caregiver, an alternate caregiver who can grow the marijuana, and the legislature at the time thought that was an acceptable way of allowing medical marijuana to be provided. you know, at that time, ever since, even ever since Raven, selling marijuana has been illegal. So, you know, you go out and you buy it on the illegal market, the person who's selling it to you is committing a crime. None of that has ever changed. But I think, I mean, my feeling is that the medical marijuana law is set up in a way to make it as convenient as possible for patients to be able to grow it or to find someone to grow it for them without making it so broad that it runs the risk of circumventing the law. My feeling is it's adequate, but if I mean, and Senator Dyson's comment about, you know, concerns like this was, well, maybe we ought to take that up in a separate bill. And I think that's probably the right approach.
Yes.
And she was incorrect that she needs a prescription to not be arrested?
That's correct. A prescription is not required, and that was specifically put in the law because there was concern at the time that there were the federal government was talking about if doctors actually prescribed illegal marijuana that they might take some action against their licenses. That was something that was maybe done in other states or threatened in other states, and so that was going on at the time. And the legislature said it doesn't have to be a prescription per se.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Guarnelli. We'll have time for members to be able to take a look at the proposed findings and other information. We'll give adequate notice to all the parties. This bill will be carried over for a future date, and we'll take a 5-minute recess. We'll come back to order. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 125. We have members from the Department of Health and Social Services here to present the bill. Welcome this morning, Dick. If you'll put yourself on the record for us, we're eager to hear your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Seekins and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Richard Monsager. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health within the Department of Health and Social Services. With me is Ms. Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law. My goal for the next few minutes is to introduce SB 125 and make a few comments about why this function is in the Division of Public Health, to introduce some amendments that we're proposing to the CS version that was passed out of HESS, and then we're both available to answer questions.
And just for the record, we're looking at the Foxtrot version of the bill.
Correct. So hopefully in front of you, you've got some slides like this. I'm just going to speak from them for a few minutes to introduce the bill. What I think you have in front of you is the F version of the bill, some amendments we'll get to in a few minutes, a handout that deals with registry, and
Dr.
then
I
this.
I don't think I have the
You don't
slides.
Have this.
We have that, Brian?
That's possible.
Well, that's why I paused here to see if you had it. Speak without it if you don't have it.
We're diligently searching here.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll go ahead and start without it.
Go ahead.
The first question is why is this bill being introduced? I'm pleased to introduce this bill on behalf of the administration, on behalf of the governor. And the bill really does two things. One is it's an administrative simplification and standardization of the licensing and certification functions in the department. That's one, and I'll speak to that. And then it also is a move that is being handled nationally to bring into our state more of a background review of employees that are working in the types of programs and facilities that serve vulnerable populations. And so I'm going to talk both about a misconduct registry and a criminal background check. So those are the two basic parts of the bill that I'm going to speak to introduce the bill. So first about how we got to where we are in the licensing and certification activities and what's been the result at present. The present statutory and regulatory environment is a very complex patchwork with the department licenses programs ranging from hospitals to hospices to assisted living homes to ambulatory surgery centers. They've all developed over time with different sets of statutes, different sets of regulations. Some of the programs have a great deal of their rules in statute. Most have it largely in regulation, but they're all different. If you're an organization that have different types of activities, you've got different administrative rules to deal with the department, depending upon the type of activity. So if you're an organization that has an ambulatory surgery center, may have residential treatment program of some sort, may have a residential group home, and may have assisted living, there's a different set of rules, different set of appeals, different regulatory scheme for every one of those different types of activities. There's really no rationale to maintain all those differences. Also, there's great differences in how different provider types are evaluated in terms of their employees and as institutions, in terms of what kind of background checks exist, if any. Some have a lot, some have none. And what, even if you do have background checks, what the effect of those are is whether there's a permanent bar to employment, a temporary bar to employment, or no effect. Another thing that's going on is CMS, the National Organization for Medicare, is pushing a move nationally to deal with this issue about background checks and to try and improve the knowledge about employees that are working in these fields, especially in the terms of long-term care. We as a state, we're one of the seven states that were awarded a pilot program grant at Christmas time of this year, and it's an opportunity for us as a state to influence a national dialogue that's going to be going on and is going on right now nationally about can we reduce the amount of fraud and abuse and neglect of people in vulnerable, that are vulnerable populations, vulnerable individuals, and it's our opportunity to influence that national debate. You now have the slides in front of you. I'm now on page 3. Current regulation of long-term care has not prevented instances of abuse and neglect. Just some stories that are there from looking at national stories from across the country and some from our state. A supported living home provider, this is a story from our state, was misappropriating funds from a resident. There is no requirement for those homes to be licensed. No background review had been conducted on the provider. Another story from elsewhere, firing of an assisted living home attendant. Facts presented to law enforcement, not judged to be severe enough, or for whatever reason the case was dropped, person is eligible to work as a provider today in another home. In another state, a person was involved in stabbing in a convenience store, violence. Months later, this person is working as a long-term care provider. Those are stories that go on today with the way we operate nationally. On page 4, right now we have 19 different programs and 12 different statutory schemes for licensure by the department. And it's a great administrative burden both to organizations and to the government to maintain this. It's very complex. Handling appeals is problematic. Care providers have a real patchwork of regulations. They have sometimes conflicting requirements depending upon what type of program they may operate if they offer more than one. For example, a care coordinator might be employable at one agency, not employable at another. And our staff, licensing and certification surveyors and licensing staff, have to learn all of these different sets of rules. So our ability to consolidate, ability to cross cover is very difficult because of these separate rules. Where we're hoping to move toward and where we're moving toward is a certification and licensing staff on behalf of the whole department to get more administrative efficiencies and to be able to cross cover. One thing I should pause for just a minute is, why am I from the Division of Public Health talking about this? Executive Order 108 was issued by the governor early in this administration, and it is in the process, it centralizes the certification and licensing activities of the department. Another important premise that the commissioner has put in place that we're moving toward is separating the licensure and certification from the payment parts of the division of the department. So for example, in public health, we don't pay for any of these services. We will be in the safety, in the quality, in the licensing. Other parts of the department pay, whether it's senior and disability services, whether it's behavioral health, healthcare services. And to create an internal tension within the department that the commissioner can have independent discussions trying to assess the licensing and quality and safety issues separated from payment. And obviously they intersect in multiple places. Right now we've integrated 3 of the different program units, and this next year 2 more will be integrated into this centralized function. Slide 5 just gives you a picture of where we are in this journey. The blue is what's happened so far, and then the purple is what will be coming over the next few years. The next couple will happen this coming year. Slide 6 gives you just...
Stop there for a second. Can you just tell me a little bit more about the Pentagon, the green Pentagon in the middle of that slide? Does it represent a new division? Does it represent... What does it sort of tell me about what's going to happen?
Certification and licensing has been created this fiscal year as a unit, a section, we call it, within the Division of Public Health.
Certification and licensing unit, I see. So it's a new unit, and you're going to slowly fold these other parts into that unit.
Right.
Okay.
Page 6 gives you a quick picture of the complexity of this, these words, licensed and certified, in all of these across this whole panoply of different types of programs. You see there's one word, hospices, that has both purple and red. That's a case where the rules are different whether you're a for-profit or a non-profit hospice, for example. And as you can see here at the bottom of page 6, what will be brought together here is all of these different consolidation activities are being brought together into one activity, one area in the department. Page 7 gives you a picture of what the proposed statute does. You can see that, and that's why the bill looks thick, is there's a lot of different statutes that exist today that affect different types of organizations and programs depending upon what type they are. For example, assisted living homes, for whenever they came, whatever the history was at the time, many of their rules are presently in statute, whereas for hospitals, very few of the rules are in statute and most are in regulation, for example. Number 8 gives you just a very quick, page 8 gives you a very quick synopsis of what's in this bill. Section 1, defining what entities to be licensed, license conditions, etc. Article 3 is new, and I'm going to talk about that here in a little bit more detail about background checks and registry functions, and then updates to existing statutes and a timeline. You can see that there is there on page 8. Page 9. For me, as I joined the department a year ago and got my hands wrapped around this, it's been important to think about an employee misconduct registry and a criminal background check separately. The proposed statute establishes new a employee misconduct registry modeled on what currently exists in the Board of Nursing for certified nurse assistants. There is a registry in place right now, and it will establish a registry of fraud, abuse, and neglect that has been reported and then substantiated in a registry. The criminal background check is another step. Let's say I'm an employee applying to an organization. Let's say this statute is law. The first step is I come in, I want to be employed. The organization, when deciding whether to accept an application, would be able to check electronically or call the office if they want to and say, Dick Monsager, is his name on the employee misconduct registry? Be able to check electronically, no reports have been substantiated, no, he's okay. Next step is, Dick Monsager, we need your fingerprints then we're going to do a criminal background check to see if there are crimes that you've been charged with or convicted of within the last 10 years. And that obviously looks at the data that's available from the criminal court system. Let's say that I'm a 30-year-old person in my early 20s. I got drunk when I was in college. I got in a bar fight, and I've got an assault and battery conviction on my record. At that point, that'll show up, and then in regulation, there will then be, and it'll be modeled on the assisted living regulations that exist today, then whether that will most likely be a temporary bar to employment that will have a certain number of years will have to add to elapse. So I graduated from college, I'm employed, I've had a good track record, and that kind of a situation then would be okay for me to be employed in this field. And the last page on page 10,
Senator
just
okay. Just while we're there on that chart, this page, because it's one of the key provisions, the third bullet point, charges of a barrier crime, it says, are sufficient to bar employment. What's a barrier crime?
barrier crime in this kind of discussion is whether it's temporary or permanent. For example, if I was a person that was trafficking child pornography, that would be a permanent barrier crime. I could never be employed.
So there's a list somewhere of what those
regulation.
Barrier crimes are.
Correct.
Okay.
Some are temporary and some will be permanent.
Go ahead.
Page 10 is just one page of dozens of pages of the current complexity of the regulations that exist today that our staff have to keep track of to give you a sense about how complicated the world is that we're dealing with right now. Let me just introduce then in a little, before I introduce some proposed amendments to the CS version, are there questions about kind of the intent of this statute?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guess.
Thank you. I'd like to go to the child care regs or focus on those only because I want to bring up two constituent cases and find out if these are going to be dealt with differently or the same as now, because it's kind of a comprehensive document. I had two constituents lose their child care license, one because of check fraud, and the second person because she was arrested for assault when she was being potentially sexually assaulted and took a crowbar to the person. When that situation was figured out, the charges were dismissed, but she lost her child care license. Both those ended up in the new regulations under the variance section. Is the variance section and how that works with child care licensing, is that continuing or is that changing? I guess my concern is people that are charged with a crime, it's dismissed, yet that charge is still there. Sometimes it's dismissed and we still don't want those folks doing child care assisted living. Sometimes it was dismissed for good reason. Can you explain kind of how that's going to be dealt with now?
If it's okay with you, through the chair, Senator Guess, I'd like to ask Ms. Grayley to try and answer it from a lawyer's perspective.
Through the chair, Senator Guess, the answer to your question is yes, it would be dealt with the same way.
Can I get you to identify yourself
for the
record?
I'm sorry, Stacey Crayley. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the
Department. Thank you, Stacey.
And let me give you a little more background. When we started this process over 2 years ago to consolidate what I call the consolidation of the 12 or 14 statutory provisions and all of that sort of thing, what we did is we took all of the statutory provisions dealing with licensure, you know, spread them out on a big conference table and looked at what was consistent throughout those. And the variance provisions is something that is a very useful tool. And so the majority of this new licensing scheme, which is found in your bill under 4732, could be very easily characterized as a cut and paste, because we kept the chunk of the licensure provisions that are consistent and the ones that are necessary for the administration of the programs, and they're still in there. So with respect to your specific question, the variance provision is still included within the new title 4732, and the same sort of processes would be available to those constituents under the new statutory scheme.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Guest, through the chair, could I just add another comment to that? The charged with language, I think, is important, as you pointed out, from both perspectives, both because we want a full picture of an individual on the front end, because sometimes charges get dropped, and on the other end, in this kind of a situation, things happen that should be able to be explained and a variance should be able to be issued. And so in the bill, there is administrative hearing process, there has to be substantiation, and there can be appeals of findings before people go on to registries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions at this point?
Let me just quickly introduce amendments we'd like to put before you, and you have two different sets of amendments, I think, in front of you. One is called Amendment to CSSB 125 Hess in Senate Judiciary. It's dated the 18th at 14:14 in the afternoon.
We have those, Brian?
Mm-hmm. You should have them in the front.
Yeah,
I've got mine. It's 12 pages long, 13 pages long.
There's one of the things that happens is anytime an amendment gets proposed to this bill, because there's so much numbers and so on, everything gets renumbered. And what I want to just talk through is what's in this amendment, because the pages make it look very, very long, and a good chunk of it is renumbering. on...
This one that we're looking at is, in, is the first line is page 8 following line 19?
Correct.
Thank you.
Senator, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Page 8 following line 19, right at the beginning there, this adds an amendment to the proposed bill that adds DHSS as the administrative hearing entity for hearings related to this registry. It exactly pertains to what Senator Guest was just asking about, to make it clear that who the hearing entity is. Page 14, line 21, adds volunteers as an entry type in the registry. And I want to clarify this and take this opportunity to comment a little bit on volunteers. There are many different types of volunteers in these organizations, and we need to encourage volunteers. There are volunteers that come and create relationships, create friendships, do care. There are family members that come in. There are Kiwanis organizations that raise money and bring in toys or gifts at Christmas time, for example. The volunteers in we would define in regulation that we're talking about non-family members, volunteers that are taking care of people in an unsupervised environment, that those would be subject to background checks. The literature across the country is a place where volunteers can establish a relationship in an unsupervised place is where potentially, just like with staff, bad things could happen. So we would propose to define it's not the whole universe of volunteers, it's a very much smaller subset. Page 14, line 22, it adds decisions to the types of findings that can result in an entry in the registry. This is hearing officers' decisions would be a substantiated finding. Page 14, line 24, adds medical assistance fraud. I've had calls from operators of a couple of different organizations wanting to make sure that this statute very specifically stated that it, if there's an employee or an organization that comes does medical assistance fraud, that goes into this registry so that they don't pick up work from one organization and go down the street and work for another employer. As one employer called me one day, he said it makes him very frustrated that if he's hired people that this has happened to, and then they commit fraud again, and then he both owes penalties and money back to Medicaid, and the person goes on and works someplace else again. So that would try and make clear that is a registry offense. Page 15, line 2, it adds some two